Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And I'd like to ask you, how powerful are you? Are you living a powerful life? Yes? Good. No? Well, let's find out how to do a better job with an author who has been on the show many times, has incredible books about power, a lot about power. And we're going to get into it even deeper now because it's going to about how be about how her own power came through a challenging life. And it's a beautiful new book that she's written, My Road to Power: Sex, Trauma, and Higher Consciousness. How about that? Does that excite you? Excites me. It was a great book. I loved reading it. And to help us understand our own roads to power, by the author of also of the bestseller The Road to Power. So now we're going to find out how she got this all, how it came about in a very challenging life. Barbara Berger, welcome. Welcome to
Thank
Energy
you.
Stew.
Thank you for having me, and what a great introduction. That was very touching. Thank you
Well, I'm always amazed by you
very
because you are such a pioneer. I mean, pioneer is a simple word to say about this life you've led, and it's all in this book, and
much.
you've put it all out there. You've bared your soul,
It was
and
difficult to do, I must say. It was difficult.
I'm sure because there are so many pages that show that you're how bold you are.
It came about because, as you know, my best-selling book, The Road to Power: Fast Food for the Soul, which has been translated to 30 different languages and has helped so many people around the world find their own power. But these people often ask me, "What about you? How did you get to be this person, Barbara? How did you figure all this out?" And then when I start to sort of talk a little bit about some of my experiences, everybody always says, "Oh, Barbara, you should write it down." And I've been hearing that for the last many, many years. So now I actually did it. I
Yeah,
wrote it down.
and in great form. And so, but it said so much. I loved every page of it only because you're so brave and bold, and you have taken chances in your life that very few people would take, which is why so many people don't feel as powerful or have lived as powerfully as you because they haven't taken these risks that you have. And it's not like you figured it all out and understood what you were doing.
No, definitely not. It's like, we're making this up as we go along thing. But on the other hand, it's true what you say, but it's also not true in the sense that now you've read the book, so you know that from a very early age, I had a very strong sense of spiritual awakening and higher
Yes,
consciousness.
I love
So,
that. And it was about an early trip to Miami. And I also had an early trip to Miami, but I didn't have the same experience that you had. Tell us about it.
well, the thing that, I mean, that's just one example that I used in the book, but I came from a very, very ordinary, materialistic Jewish background. My father and mother grew up in New York, and they grew up on Riverside Drive, where you live. And the whole family, their parents were immigrants from Europe, and they worked in the garment district. And so everything was about success and money and material, gaining more material things and money, all that. But I was different from the get-go. I don't know why the universe planted me in this family, but they did. And there was nothing in my environment that spoke of other things, but somehow or other, I knew that there was something else, that there was something more. And as I describe in the book, from a very young age, every winter we went to Miami Beach, and that was the thing they did. And they ate and they played pinochle and they played canasta on the beach and all that. And then there would be the sunset, the time of day when the beach time was over, and they would all go back to the hotel rooms to have a nap. And sleep and get ready for dressing up for dinner and going out and eating. And I used to stay alone on the beach and wander around because something would happen to me in that quietude. I call it Om Satchitananda, divine bliss consciousness. Something would happen to me. I would have access to higher realms or other dimensions or this infinite peace. And so already at a very young age, but I didn't have the language. I didn't have any spiritual teachers. I didn't have anyone who knew anything about any of these things. And of course, I never told anyone about it. But I'm just saying that that was an experience that was with me from the beginning. My son, Tim Ray, who you know, who also writes spiritual books and who has worked with me for many years, he always says, "Oh, Mom, you're the reincarnation of a Tulka or a Buddhist monk, or you came with this information already in your soul." And it seems true enough because there's no explanation in the outer for what I experienced. It was an inner knowingness.
Well, that allowed you to be so brave because somehow you had these other experiences of wholeness, of oneness, that you were willing to trust taking risks. And the book is loaded with that. And it's amazing.
On the other hand, I wouldn't say that I was willing to take risks in the way you formulated. It was more that I was driven to, I knew that my mission or my job or whatever you wanted to call it was that I should try to find how do we ease human suffering? What's going on with this crazy world? I mean, I had that drive in me from a very early age too, that was what I was supposed to do. So it wasn't so much that I was brave. It was that I could do no other.
But I think that was the author in you, knowing you have all these books to write. You know, your soul knew that ahead of time.
I think so too, because I always was writing from very, very young age and writing constantly. It was my only solace, you could say. It was how I comforted myself and talked to myself because I was so alone in all of that, I felt all the time.
Yeah, it's so beautiful, this experience, all of these experiences you've had. And that's why this book is so rich, because you go from one to another that is mind-boggling. And yet there's so much depth in understanding it from this point of view.
Well, thank you for saying that. Well, again, and then you could say that life put me in the situation that I had a boyfriend by the time I was a teenager, and I had been struggling in my family of origin the whole way through, and it was a very dysfunctional family, and I felt very alone and didn't know how to deal with it. But anyway, I had all these boyfriends, and then I had a boyfriend when I was like 17, and I have to say my father was a high military man who worked in the Pentagon. But that was why we lived in Washington, D.C., in a suburb in Bethesda, Maryland, because my father worked in the Pentagon. And then there was the Vietnam War. And this guy I had fallen in love with, he got drafted because he dropped out of college. Steve Berger was his name. He dropped out of college. I was still in high school. And that did not go down well in my family. And then I got into Sarah Lawrence, and I went to New York, and you know, Steve and I, then we got married because my parents would not let me go. And I was underage. And at that time in New York, if the man was 21 and the woman was 18, then I didn't need parental permission to marry Steve. And so on the day after he turned 21, we went to the courthouse in Yonkers and got married. It took like 2 seconds, but we did it because I wanted to be free. And so it's not like I wanted to get married, and it's not like he wanted to get married, but it was the only way out of that family prison that I found myself in. And there's a lot of details about that in the book if you want to read it. But after that, and then we did some traveling and so on, but then because of the Vietnam War and because Steve had dropped out of college, he got drafted. And this was in the early 60s. So we were sort of the first wave of the young people who were against the Vietnam War. And so many of these adventures that you refer to, this started when we tried to leave the United States and go abroad because Steve was gonna, I mean, it was, he couldn't be a conscientious objector, and he would get 5 years in jail if he didn't show up. I mean, he got called, he went to Whitehall Station, just like an Alice's restaurant, the whole thing. And so we had to disappear. And we did. And
But it's amazing. The book is so rich of the journey of you trying to disappear. Like, you took a boat to Europe. And in those days, boats were common. And that's how we got to Europe. I had my opportunity to do that too. But then what happened when you got there? You couldn't get off the ship.
It was amazing. We went on this boat and it was filled with hippies. The whole boat was all long-haired guys and long-haired girls, and everybody was smoking dope and everybody was, you know, singing protest songs. And the guy from Berkeley who made the famous speech, Mario Salvio, I think his name was, he was on the boat. So there was lots of us. And when we came to England, the boat was going to dock in Southampton. When we came to Southampton, then, you know, they put the ramp up and everybody sort of walked off the boat except us. They stopped us and they said we couldn't get off. And it was like, what? You know, like, why us? I mean, it was like we weren't any different from any of the other people. And so we couldn't get off. They wouldn't let us off. And everybody else got off the boat. And then we were locked up on this boat for 3 days and three nights. And there was a captain of the boat. He was still on the boat, and he took pity with us because he thought, that what's with this, these two young people? What did they do? So he would invite us to dinner every night in his cabin, and we drank wine and has feasted with this captain. And then after 3 days and three nights, the police came and got us. And there was two of them. There was one for Steve, a man, and one for me, the woman. And they handcuffed. We were handcuffed to these people.
It's amazing.
And then they were going to take us. And they were going to take us to Heathrow Airport and put us on an airplane and send us back to America. We were getting deported, but we had many hours until the flight was taking off. And I had never been in England. And we came driving from Southampton up to London. And I just said, I was really looking forward to seeing London. I've never been there before. And then these two policemen, they also felt sorry for us. They said, okay, we'll show you around. So we had our own police car, police escort. They drove us around and we saw the Parliament and Big Ben and all of that stuff. And then they finally took us to the airport and they took us up the plane and to the captain. And they gave the captain our passports and said, he was not to let us off the airplane until we came to New York, because the plane was going from London to Scotland to Iceland to Newfoundland.
And you might have escaped.
Exactly. And so we were stuck on this plane, and we were sure that when we would come to New York, I mean, what was this about, that Steve was going to be arrested, that there would be the military police would be waiting for us when we got to the airport. So we landed in New York and we went through customs and nothing happened. And no one was waiting for us. Nothing happened. It was like we just couldn't figure out what this was all about.
Until you thought about your father.
Well, that was the first many, many years later, as I write in the book, I got to know a British diplomat very well. And one day I told him this story, just to find out what he thought about it. And he said, oh, Barbara, obviously it was your father's doing that something like that could happen. He said, there's no other explanation.
Right.
But I never asked my father, so I don't know this day.
I want to go on to other ways that you had to escape your family. And and yet you always, your father was basically a good guy. He wasn't the troubling parent that your mother was.
That's for sure.
But he never did come to your rescue about her, and
No.
that's a very important thing in life, to have a you know, one parent who's the shrew and the other who just doesn't show up against the shrew.
He didn't. It was very, very sad. In
Yeah.
fact, the last time I saw him before he died, many, many years later, he cried and apologized and said that he was sorry that he had never stood up
Oh,
for me.
that's wonderful. That's a good way to complete with him. That's good. But you know, this is so fascinating, and this is such a small segment of how many fascinating experiences you've had throughout your life and are in the book. And so
well,
that's
I think the other one that we could mention here in the start, if we're going to continue this discussion on another session,
yes,
is
please.
That how did I end up in Scandinavia? So it's part of this story. So when we got back to New York, what were we going to do then? And so it was not safe for us to be in New York because though in those days, they were looking for people who, it was before there was the big wave of draft dodgers. So we went to Canada. That we just had this idea, okay, where can we go now? And this was before all the, so many people did go to Canada. Eventually, a lot of people, draft dodgers, went to Canada, but we went before anybody was there, and it was cold and we didn't have any money. And so then we ended up, we said, okay, we'll go to Mexico. So we hitchhiked to Mexico. It took us 3 weeks. It was a long journey because Mexico was like the last place that we could go to, and we didn't have money.
Well, but
so,
before that, Barbara, before that, you had gone to Israel. You lived on a kibbutz together.
Yeah, but that's before Steve got drafted.
Oh, okay. But that was also a revelation about life. Because you thought the kibbutz would be freedom for you to be experiencing fullness of life. And it didn't work out very well because you were different than the other people in the kibbutz.
It was another Jewish homeland that was not so
so open. But let's come back to Mexico, because getting to Mexico was a journey that also is kind of like what happened to you when you were 12. And
I had a really, really powerful awakening experience in on this journey. And that happened after, again, smoking too much dope, getting stoned, being afraid, traveling, the hardships of the journey. At one point, I really, really freaked out and had a bad trip. And that was in Mazatlan, once we were in Mexico. And so when I came out of that state, I was so much in shock. And then we thought, okay, we better go to Mexico City and get somewhere. We didn't have very much money left. And so we got on this train in Guadalajara. And that was like an all-night train up the mountain to Mexico City. And we only could afford to be in third class, which was filled with people with animals and goats and chickens and children. And it was like, and there were these wooden benches that people were sleeping on and trying to sit on and so on. And then as the train slowly went up the mountain, I had this most amazing moments of, I don't know what to call it. We call it cosmic consciousness, or seeing the unity of all things, understanding the web of life. I tried to explain it to write. I have a section in the book where I tried to write it down when I came to Sweden later, what the way that experience played out, and so you can read it in the book. But I was completely stunned, and I was completely, it's beyond words, this kind of, you can't describe it in words. But after that, I knew that everything was the way it was supposed to be, it always is, and that the divinity that is within me, or within you and within each of us, it became so apparent to me.
Yeah, this is a great gift. that it was given to
and
you.
So this kind of thing that happened to me, and then just to sort of finish it up before we run out of time, that when we finally got to Mexico City, the very first day, we didn't know anyone. We only had $150 left. We didn't speak Spanish. It was like, what were we doing there, and what were we gonna do? And so we wandered around, and we ended up in this big park in the center of Mexico City, and we sat down on a bench, and we were just sort of staring at nothing.
Yeah, forlorn.
What are we going to do? And there was this guy, a really tall, very interesting looking man, looked like kind of out of a Dostoevsky novel, who was wandering around, and he was drawing people, sketching. He had this big thing, white paper. And then finally he came over to us and said, oh, you're so beautiful, the two of you. Can I sketch your faces? And we said, go ahead. We didn't care. And so he sat down on the grass before us and he started sketching us. And then suddenly he stopped and put his block of paper down and he said, what are you doing here? And up until that point, we never told anyone that we were running away from the U.S. Army and that we were afraid. And we just said, you know, we were visiting relatives or we were students or something like that. But for some reason, again, divine intervention, I just blurted it all out. It wasn't Steve, it was me. I said, we're on the run from the U.S. Army. We're against the Vietnam War. We don't have any money. We're scared. We're here. We don't know what to do. I just said it all. And he just sat quietly, this guy, and listened. And then he said, I'm a pacifist, and I'm from Sweden, and I think you're doing the right thing. And I will take you home with me to Sweden and take care of you, so you don't need to worry.
It's amazing.
He just said that. And it was like, oh my God. And he did. It was true. He took us to Sweden. It turned out he was a very famous Swedish artist, and his brother was a famous journalist on Sweden's biggest newspaper, like the New York Times of Sweden. And when we came to Sweden, we suddenly became minor heroes. You know, like we were like the young Americans who were saying no to the Vietnam War. There were newspaper interviews and articles, and we were on TV. And it was like, I mean, it was so confusing.
It's amazing.
Such a shock. Yeah, and I was so young. I mean, and then because I was so traumatized, and the book that I wrote now is called Sex, Trauma, and Higher Consciousness. So I was so traumatized by all of these experiences that I had. So for some reason, the only thing I could think of to do was to write. And so I started writing down I called it the journey, what had happened and what we had been through and so on. And then one day this man who was visiting us, he said, what are you writing, Barbara? Can I look at it? And I said, go ahead. And so he took this manuscript, and without asking me, he gave it to one of the biggest publishers in Sweden. And then suddenly I get a call, they want to publish this book. And I was only 20 years old then. So I suddenly became famous in Sweden and Denmark and Norway. And like I was the voice of the young Americans. And there was all this stuff in the newspapers and articles. And so it was like from lowly to holy suddenly. It was just... So that was also really, really an amazing experience that all these things happened in that short time frame.
But your life is full of serendipity and synchronicity.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's
but
amazing.
Anyway, but anyway, so that's sort of the beginning of this journey, you could say, which I try to share as honestly as I can in the book. These
right.
awakening experiences, but the things that happened, that, as you say, who would have thought sitting there on a bench in Mexico City, and here I am still live in Scandinavia. I live in Copenhagen, Denmark. So obviously the universe wants me to be here.
It's amazing. I think also your soul wanted you to be there because it knew what you're supposed to be up to in this life. And so the book goes on and on with so many stories of what happened, how you got from Sweden to Denmark and unique places you lived with Steve, and then your life went on also, and we'll talk about this in a subsequent show, because I love talking with you about this, and I want my audience to enjoy who you are and what you're about, and how much that you challenged life to develop your wisdom and power. So it's amazing to me. I was thrilled with every page of your book.
And, I lost you the last couple minutes.
Oh, okay.
I
guess I have a weak connection, but I'm thrilled with every page of your book about how driven you were to take risks to develop your wisdom and power. You didn't know you were doing that. You were just open to explore. And a journalist who knew how to write it all down, and it got better and better. And I can't say better and better. I mean, it became in the end better and better, but along the way it was harder and harder. So we're going to have a subsequent show where you'll be able to help our audience enjoy what it takes to find your own road to power. And so your book is, the new book is My Road to Power, and your famous book already is The Road to Power. And this explains what made that happen. And I'm fascinated. I've always been fascinated by you, because we've done many, many shows about many, many of your books. And it goes on and on. In this book, I can't wait to talk with you about so many other challenges and experiences and risks you took. It's amazing. So we'll be talking again very soon, hopefully in a subsequent week, because I just love to talk with you about this, because you're fascinating, but for a point, you're fascinating for a particular point, and that's to help people grow and become themselves in better ways and become powerful. And it's beautiful to see. So thank you for being a guest on Energy Stew again. I love talking with you, of course, and
thank you.
And we will come back again soon.
We will. God bless you. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so happy to. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.live. I can be reached at peter@heartriver.org. I'd love to hear from you. And thanks so much for listening.